Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. In 1993, three young boys, Stephen Edward Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore, were in the second grade, best friends in the Cub Scouts, and were sexually assaulted and brutally murdered in West Memphis, Tennessee. Damian Nichols, our guest today, along with Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., were accused of committing those murders. The three teenagers were known as the West Memphis Three and were convicted in 1994 for those crimes. They always maintained their innocence. Many believe it was only because they were young and goth-like that they were ever charged during a wave of fear around satanic cults. After years of professing their innocence and folks fighting for their release, the three were released from prison last year. The real killers of these children have never been brought to justice. And we've interviewed a lot of innocent people who have spent time on death row and in prison for decades. And here's another, Damian Nichols, who wrote about his life, and here's our conversation with him. Damian Nichols, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. It's just an honor and a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Damian, this is the story. I know you're probably ad nauseum, just tired of the story of what happened to you, just in terms of telling it over and over again. But the idea that an 18-year-old kid has his trailer busted into and then is accused of murder and goes through what you went through, it's important for people to hear again just what that means for somebody to be a teenager and young and isolated and alone, to be accused of these heinous crimes that you know, in fact and in your heart and soul, you didn't do.
Yeah, it destroys you inside and out on every single level. You know, it physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, it's like having a bomb go off on every single level of your psyche. To see your entire world, your entire life completely destroyed, to see everything you've ever known just completely ripped apart, you go into a state of shock and trauma that's so deep that it's hard to even articulate it to most people. And, you know, one of the things we look at whenever we're doing this is, you know, to be quite honest, I am sick to death of talking about this case.
Right, right.
You know, it's not fun for me. It's not something that I enjoy. You know, it's almost like the wound never has a chance to heal just because, you know, you're always having to rip the Band-Aid off. But for us, it's almost like a necessary evil. You know, if we don't keep pushing this case forward, then not only will we never be completely exonerated, but the same thing will happen to other people in the future.
It's true. And I think that's one of the powers of your book, besides your own personal story and how you actually even wrote this book, not as a... Well, I mean, when you wrote it, let's get into that for a minute, because even as you wrote this book wasn't, for you, some cathartic exercise after you were released. This is stuff that you wrote while you were being incarcerated for these 18 years.
Yeah, I started writing it about 7 years ago, somewhere in that area, and 85% of it was written, as I said, in a cell on death row. Very little was written since I've been out. The vast majority of what was written was mostly editorial and cosmetic stuff. You know, for example, they would say, okay, you've got this piece here and this piece here, and what we need you to do now is go back and write 20 more pages that sort of bridge these two together. So that's what I would do, but the vast majority of the heavy lifting was done while I was on death row. And I always had this feeling that I was sort of writing for myself. You know, writing was something that really helped me deal with that place and that situation on a day-to-day basis. But at the same time, always in the back of my mind, I sort of always had this, you know, little thing there that maybe someday this writing is going to mean something to someone else. Maybe someday it's going to help someone else or touch someone else in some sort of way. So it was almost like I was doing it half for myself and half for someone else that I didn't even know yet.
You know, it's been, what, 14 months since you've been freed from prison? Is that about right?
Yeah, just about. Yeah.
And you know, and I've listened to other interviews you've done over the course of the last year and read other interviews and read your book. And I'm just hearing your voice now. It's like it's hearing the voice of a different human being than it was a year ago, a year and a half ago. Like, you know, I mean, 14 months ago, whatever that was. I mean,
definitely. You know, when I first came out of prison, I'd been in solitary confinement for almost a decade by that point. So whenever I did come out, I was in, you know, I wasn't used to any human interaction at all. So just coming out and being overloaded all at one time with the world, it sent me into a really deep, profound state of shock. And I didn't even begin coming out of that for a good 3 months.
I mean, you could hear it in your voice. I mean,
yeah,
it was just like I've met a lot of men who have come off of death row and out of life imprisonment who were innocent and were finally freed. I felt what you were going through because having spent time with those other men and hearing their stories. But I mean, you were such a child when it happened to you.
Yeah, I was 18.
Yeah,
18, and I spent 18 years in. So literally half my life was spent in prison on death row. You know, we lived in this really small, hardcore fundamentalist town deep in the Bible Belt in the Deep South. So whenever this happened, you know, it completely just rocked the entire community. It was on every single news station, every single newspaper. It was all everybody talked about. And the crimes at the time were so horrific that the only thing people could think of is, oh, it must have been Satanist. It must have been Satanist. And this was also during a time whenever we were in what they now call satanic panic. It's when you had cases from one end of this country to the other where people were being accused of just about anything you can imagine. People were saying there was this huge underground network of Satanists that had infiltrated every layer of society and were carrying out tens of thousands of human sacrifices a year, and just all of this insane stuff. And it was almost like the whole country got swept up in it and believed it, and we were part of that hysteria.
And I know you put a lot on West of Memphis as making that documentary film about this particular story of these three children being murdered so brutally and your story about being incarcerated, and you place a lot of your ability to get free, even though it's a weird being free because this Alfred plea we'll talk about in a minute, but that you place a lot on that film as a reason why you were able to walk free.
Well, West of Memphis hasn't actually opened yet.
I mean Paradise Lost. I apologize.
Paradise Lost. We were lucky enough. What happened is there was a tiny little article in the New York Times one day that said something about there had been a satanic sacrifice in Arkansas. And someone at HBO saw it and said, well, why don't we send cameras down there to get this on film because this is going to be pretty sensational and grotesque and fantastic. So they sent these cameras down there, and as the trial started and they're filming this whole thing, they realized, wait a minute, these guys aren't actually guilty. Something else is going on here. So we were just fortunate enough that they had those TV cameras in the courtroom. If not for getting that trial on film, the state would have murdered us and swept us under the rug a long time ago.
And I'm glad you and others, you use that word a lot, and I'm glad others use it as well, because it's real. You're talking about the state murdering other human beings who are completely innocent of anything they've been accused of. And it would have been murder of three men.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. You know, I've seen people executed on their, you know, they had a guy, for example, that the DNA at the crime scene did not match this guy. And they went ahead and killed him anyway, executed him, because the media wasn't paying any attention to his case. Nobody knew who he was. So there was nothing in it for them to gain by letting him out or exonerating him or anything else. So they just went ahead and killed the guy. You can have all the evidence in the world pointing to your innocence, and it won't do you one bit of good unless somehow you can get that information out to the outside world. You know, it really, the evidence is only 50% of the battle. You've also got to have people paying attention to it.
And pay attention, they did, and things began to. I mean, you were saved, but this whole weird thing about how you got out with this Alfred plea. I mean, you have to basically say, yeah, I guess you could say I did it, but I didn't.
Yeah, it's a really weird plea in the American judicial system. Almost no one has even heard of it because it's so rare. What it comes down to is you get to maintain your innocence, but you're saying, yes, I accept this guilty plea. I'm pleading guilty to this, whatever it is the prosecutor brings to the table. And the whole reason, the entire existence for this plea is so that you can walk out of prison, but you can't sue the state. You know, that was their very first question. Would we sign a waiver giving up all rights to sue the state of Arkansas? And what happened is as all the DNA evidence started coming in that was pointing towards someone else, as new eyewitnesses were coming forward. The prosecutor says, yeah, when we go back to court, you're going to win this case, but we can stretch it out for another 5 years, another 10 years, or you can sign this agreement and you can walk home before the week is out. So I also knew, you know, they can have you stabbed to death in prison for a pack of cigarettes. Stuff like that happens all the time. Nobody questions it. So I knew whether it was through some sort of act like that, or whether it was just getting so sick that I couldn't recover. If I didn't take this deal, I was never going to live to see the outside of those walls. It's horrific in there. It's, you know, prison is a business, just like any other business, They want to make money. They want to keep their costs down. They started at one point privatizing prisons in Arkansas, allowing these companies to open up their own prisons. And what happened, it got so bad that you had guys in there who hadn't even been given shoes for years at a time. And eventually the state had to come back in and take over them just because they got so brutal and so horrific. But, I mean, just one single example, the warden at the prison where I was when I got out, he had been a prison guard at another prison and had beaten an inmate so bad he lost an eye. Well, the outside newspapers heard about it, wrote a couple stories about it. The administration says, well, we got to get this guy out of here. He's bringing too much attention on the prison. So instead of firing him, they promote him, make him warden, and send him to my prison. Mm. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that happens all the time in there. Number one priority, cover it up, cover it up, cover it up.
And you were beaten near to death almost every day after you were arrested.
It was it went on. The worst time went on for a period of about 18 days whenever I first got there. They took me back to this part of the prison they call the hole. It's just this dark, filthy little cell and in complete isolation. They can do whatever they want to you. And they'll come in at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, chain you to the bars of the cell, punch you, hit you with nightsticks. They really just messed me up bad for a while, you know, so bad enough that I started to piss blood for a little while. And I still have trouble with my kidneys to this day. And the only reason they didn't kill me, go even further with it, is because other inmates in the prison started to hear about it. And they went to a deacon from the Catholic Church who was coming to the prison to bring inmates communion. And they told him. And this deacon goes to the warden and says, I know what you're doing. I know you're killing this guy. And if it doesn't stop, I'm going to go public with it. I'm going to start telling people. So that's the only reason they didn't beat me all the way to death.
So I want to turn to some things that really are one of these interesting pieces of your life and where you are now and the love story with you and Laurie Davis, which is a big part of your book as well, I think is really important, how the film Paradise Lost in some ways introduced the two of you. But you also see that your introduction to one another as almost meant to be a kind of a spiritual tie that's almost hard to kind of describe.
That's exactly right. We've been together for about 17 years now. We got married in 99. But I knew from the very first letter that I ever received from her that she was completely and absolutely unlike anyone I'd ever known before. You know, there was just something so magical about her that it made me want to see the world through her eyes. You know, to me, the world had become a dark, revolting, repugnant place in a lot of ways. And then seeing the world through her eyes, it made it more fantastical, more magical, something that I didn't shun anymore or just want to be rid of. You know, it made me want to be part of life again. It sort of restored my faith in humanity a little, I guess. And we got married in 99. It eventually ended up where she was doing more work on my case. She had to quit her job and work full-time on my case. She did at least 85% of the work in this case, more than the attorneys and investigators put together. And, you know, there were times when we couldn't even afford to pay legal fees anymore, and she would take out personal loans just to pay off our legal bill.
That part of your story is just lovely, and the fact that you two are living together now and able to be together and have a house, and that's in some ways must have been like a shock for you. I mean, just getting out, there's your wife, and eventually moving to this house, which is in Salem, Massachusetts, where you live.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is odd.
It's been hard just this whole year in general because we had to hit the ground running. You know, when I got out and we left Arkansas, we left literally like refugees. I did not have one single penny in my pocket. I didn't have a change of clothes. We had nowhere to go. So we had to hit the ground just scrambling, desperately to put some sort of life together for ourselves. And I guess it was that, just having to struggle like that and not really having much time for reflection or anything else, that kind of got us past a lot of the shock and the trauma and sort of living into, I guess, as normal a state of life as we can be in right now.
So you've got this new film coming out, West of Memphis, about the struggle and about you. And so, I mean, will you have time to stop and reflect? Have you had time to just sit down for a minute?
Not a lot, no. You know, we've been on the road. I had to, you know, I was finishing up the book and then going through the editing process. We've been traveling almost nonstop since I've been out. You know, now we're doing the book tour, going from state to state, doing book signings. Really, it's been, you know, just for example, we've lived in Salem for about a month now.
Mm-hmm.
And in that month, I think we've been able to be home for maybe like a week out of that month, just because, you know, we're just all over the place.
So, I mean, it's also funny. I was thinking about how you all chose to live in Salem, given its history. In America, the oppression of women and witchcraft and satanic rituals, which is what happened to you, and you're living in Salem with its own set of ghosts.
That's part of it. You know, whenever I was in prison, I had this list of things that I thought, if I ever get out of this place, one day I want to do this and this and this. And number one on the list was go see a Boston Red Sox game. And so we went up there. We got to see that. While we were there, we said, you know what, let's go to Salem. I've always wanted to see Salem, always read about it. Let's go there. Went there, fell in love with the place, went back a couple of more times. And we had been staying in New York for nearly most of the time I'd been out, actually, just because we didn't have anywhere to go. And we had a friend there who said, look, I've got this apartment I'm not using, so why don't you use it as long as you need it to get your feet up under you? So we moved to New York, and we knew we couldn't stay there. You know, it just cost an arm and a leg to live in a place like that. And we started wanting more room, a slower paced life, things like that. So one day we woke up and we were like, why don't we go to Salem? Why don't we move there? We loved it. And while we were there, we were doing this tour. They called it Ghost Walk, where this tour guide takes you around all these haunted locations and tells you the history of these places. And they were talking about the witch hangings that happened there. And the guy says, that's why Massachusetts is such a blue state now, because we learned our lesson back then. And to me, I was like, you know what? This is where I want to live. And not only that, but it's become sort of a mecca for people of all sorts of alternative spiritual traditions and practices. You know, I can walk one street over from my house and get acupuncture. So, you know, it's like the one place in the world where I'm sort of in the majority.
That's a good thing, man. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, when you say that, I mean, you had a certain, because of your isolation as a kid, your own kind of spiritual development as a poor kid growing up in West Memphis, that you took on yourself, developed more even when you're isolated in prison. But it's developed more, I think, since you've gotten out of prison, right?
Well, to me, that's always been the number one important thing in life. Your spirituality, your spiritual practice, your spiritual search, whatever it is, you know, everything else to me has always seemed secondary to that. And I don't really, you know, put any name on myself anymore. I mean, if you ask the Catholic Church, they have me enrolled as a member of the Catholic Church.
Right.
But at the same time, I've also received ordination in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism, which is the same tradition that used to train the samurai warrior. You know, I've for years, what I've done in my practice, I had to learn things like Reiki and Qigong, you know, energy work when I was in prison, just because I didn't have any other sort of health care. So over the years, I just sort of incorporated. That's why I spell magic in the book with a K.
Right.
I always spell it M-A-G-I-C-K. And the reason is because that differentiates it from pulling rabbits out of hats and sawing people in half and prestidigitation, you know, all those things. With a K at the end of it, what it means is like it's a combination of Gnostic Christianity, mystical Judaism, Taoism from the East, A lot of the chakra exercises, also from different Indian and Hindu traditions. It's like all of these things amalgamated into one supercharged spiritual practice, and that's what magic means when it's spelled with a K at the end.
And I just find that fascinating, and I love that that piece about you. I also, one of the things that struck me reading the book and then reading more about you was that your writing and what the public library meant to you as a little boy, even though you were poor, dirt poor. Books and writing hit you as a kid, even when you were a loner, and used the public library, which means a lot to me. I'm on the board here in Baltimore, the Enoch Pratt Free Library, which is our library, and I hear stories a lot from poor kids growing up saying, if I didn't have the library, I would never learn how to read and write. And that was your story, too.
Oh, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. You know, back then, we didn't have the internet. There was no internet. My family was so poor, we could not afford to spend money on things like books. You know, it took everything we had just to survive day to day, making sure we've got enough food to eat and things like that. So there was no money for books. So the only thing I had was the public library. And I would go to the public library for hours at a time and just read to escape that life, to escape that level of poverty. It was, you know, I didn't have movie theaters. And even if there would have been movie theaters, I wouldn't have had the money to go to them. All I had was the public library. And I only have a ninth grade education now. I dropped out of school when I was in ninth grade. Pretty much everything I know has been self-taught. And the way I learned how to write was by reading Stephen King novels over and over. You know, I fell in love with those books when I was 10 or 11 years old and have read them ever since. And some of them I've read in the double digits. And that's what taught me how to write, is just the love of reading.
But, and you are a good writer. I mean, you are a good writer in prison, and I imagine your writing has gotten better.
I would hope so. That's what I'm hoping.
So what do you want to do with that?
I think I want to keep writing. I've loved writing ever since I was probably 12 years old. You know, it's like it scratches an itch somewhere deep inside you that nothing else gets to. So I love doing it, and what I'm hoping with Life After Death is that people will like the voice of it, they'll like the style and structure and everything else, but they'll want to read about more than just the case. You know, they'll want to read other things that I write, which will allow me to, you know, expand and start writing about other experiences that I've had and things like that. That's what I would love to do. But I also, one day in Salem, I just want to have a small meditation center somewhere where I can share the things with people that I had to learn while I was in prison, the things that helped me to survive. I want to be able to pass that on to others who are in desperate situations and hard times and need something to help them get through.
What do you think it is about men like you, as you, who have gone through this experience of death row or life imprisonment, that can somehow then come out, shed it in a sense to be able to become whole human beings, not hold this deep resentment and open yourself up to the world. I mean, there's to me something special about the men I've known on death row, and it feels like the same thing coming from you.
To be honest,
yeah.
I think it's pain. I think that's what it comes down to, is pain. You know, I think pain is something that we don't want, we don't like, we try to avoid it as much as possible. But in the end, I think it's the number one thing that forces us to grow as human beings. You know, it forces you to grow even when you don't want to, almost against your will. And usually people in those situations have seen a great deal of pain. I think that's what it all comes down to.
So do you think that part of your existence will be this kind of crusade also to make people aware of that, end the death penalty, maybe even abolish prisons altogether?
Yeah, I'm actually sitting in Minnesota right now, getting ready to speak at an Innocence Project gala tonight. And one of the things, you know, it'll help them raise money to be able to work on more cases of innocent people on death row. But I also think anytime I do something like this, like anytime I'm in a book signing or talking to people, every single person that is hearing you speak is a potential jury member. One day, each and every one of them could end up on someone's jury. And it's the experience of hearing you talk that may prevent them from doing the same thing to someone that was done to me.
Well, we can only hope that's the case. I mean, and really fight for it. I think that what you went through You know, the shows that if it wasn't for the happenstance of an HBO crew coming in to look at a case they thought was weird and strange, this horrendous killing of these three young babies, what people call a satanic killing, that opened the door to freedom for you, but opened the door of America to your story. But that was happenstance, you know?
Yeah, it was. It was just a fluke. You know, the same thing happens to people all the time, all over this country, and they just aren't fortunate enough to have a camera in the courtroom to catch it on film.
So at some point, all of this, even though there's this new film coming out west of Memphis, so that's going to kind of continue your journey in many ways with America. At some point, this is going to come, that part of your life is going to come to an end.
Yes.
This whole persona, Damian Nichols, out of prison, Damian Nichols book, Damian Nichols documentary, number two, West of Memphis, and it'll be Damian Nichols and Laurie Davis and your world.
That's actually what I'm looking very forward to.
I'm sure you are. I mean, to figure out what kind of a normalcy might even be like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because right now, I still haven't had normal yet.
Well, I hope you get to normal soon, brother. I really do.
Thank you.
I look forward to that for you, and I appreciate you taking this time with our listeners here, the Mark Steiner Show on WBA. I appreciate your forthrightness, the book that you wrote, and wish you only the best, brother.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on today.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.